Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority.
My guest today is Nina Davis, who's recently joined the Society. She's going to talk about her experience of Buddhism, her work in adult social care, doing VSO in Malawi, how feminism is really important in her life, her family, how she joined the Society, and what the Middle Way means to her. Hello, Nina. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Hello, Barry.
Okay, now, you grew up in Singapore, Nina. Can you start by telling us something about that?
Yes, I spent the last 2 years of my schooling in Singapore, which it very much feels as if I grew up there. They were very important years to me. And I went to a United World College in Singapore, and it was a very nurturing and very formative experience where I began to form ideas about international understanding and to be very interested in people from different backgrounds, cultures. And that led me on to want to study anthropology at university, social anthropology.
Okay, and that's when you were first exposed to Buddhism, is that right?
Yes, that's right, definitely. Yes, I was. I knew something about Buddhism from school, as a primary school, as a young child. But when I went to Singapore, I was able to come into contact with the blend of Taoism and Buddhism that existed very much in Singapore, and the different ways in which the different Buddhist communities worshipped and understood Buddhism.
Okay, and was that a big influence on you?
It certainly was. I had part of my schooling was philosophy, and I can remember a Buddhist nun coming to the school to talk to us, and I suppose at that age I was very impressed with how she appeared to have all the answers, whereas people from different religions like Christianity and Islam didn't have all the answers, and I think I came later on to become very suspicious of her having all the answers, actually. But certainly as a teenager, it very much impressed me.
Okay, and then when did you come back to the UK?
Well, I came to university. I came to the University of Sussex and studied social anthropology in the School of African and Asian Studies.
And that was, as you said, the choice for that was very much influenced by...
Yeah, by my experience in Singapore, very much so. It's a very mixed society, as well as attending a school with 40 different nationalities. It was also a very, very mixed city to live in, and I was fascinated by the cultural difference and the expression of that difference, and that's why I studied anthropology.
And then when you left university, what did you do?
I became an English teacher.
All right.
I was taught English as a foreign language.
Oh, me too. Robert Ellis as well, he was a TEFL teacher.
Was he? Yeah. So, yes, that's obviously very important to anyone too. So I did that for a little while before I got my first job in social care.
Why did you move into social care, do you think?
Well, it was coming back to the UK and wondering what to do, really. So it was falling into it to some extent.
Yeah.
But it was a transference of my skills. I was able to initially teach on an education program for people with enduring mental health issues, and later I did group work in a drug and alcohol rehab. It was really, and that was, both experiences were fascinating, and I learned a huge amount in that time about, I suppose, that there's always a cause for illness, and there's always a cause for addiction. And it's never as simple as to say it's a disease. It's never as simple as to say it's an illness.
So it
was very, very important to me. And then I have gone on working in adult social care through the rest of my career, and together with housing as well. So homelessness, working in the front line of homelessness for much of the time, has brought me into contact with some very interesting people with very interesting backgrounds, and who have experienced the most tremendous amount of suffering in their lives.
Was it from an early age that you were drawn to a more vocational type of work?
I guess I was. I always wanted to be a teacher, but the national curriculum came in when I was at university, which precluded me at that point in time from being a teacher, because obviously anthropology wasn't on the teaching list or on the national curriculum list. I believe I could now teach religious studies or citizenship if I wanted to at this point, but. In a way, I feel very fortunate that I didn't do that, and that I was forced to think a little bit more deeply about what I wanted to do. And certainly, when I had the chance or the opportunity to work in a drug and alcohol rehab, it very much became a passion for me.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated, and I wanted to learn as much as I could from these people that I felt it was my privilege to be able to work with. And it still inspires me, being in the position to watch people change.
Yeah.
And it's real change, you know, it's real and meaningful change. It's not small change, it's quite radical change. I don't work in that field anymore because it is very all-consuming. But I continue to work with people.
Mm-hmm.
And love working with people, always questioning, you know, what can be done to improve things, every day I come up against the hierarchies that exist in our society, which seem to keep things as they are, not least the medical profession.
Mm-hmm.
And the structures of adult social care, I suppose, that I work in as well, that seem to define people. And I don't think people understand their own power in those structures. I don't think for a minute that doctors intend to infantize people, but that's my experience, that they do that they take people's choice away.
Have you, you know, because you've been in this field for a while, have you noticed changes in that regard? If you compare it to how the doctor-patient relationship 20 or 30 years ago, would you say there's more empathy now, or you've not noticed much difference?
I don't think there's a lot of room for empathy because the time constraints are so huge. I think psychiatrists and doctors are very empathetic people.
Yeah.
But the way that their workplace, I suppose, their hierarchies are structured, they have so little time with their patients that I don't think that they're able to make very person-centered decisions. I think, you know, in general, psychiatrists see their patients for 15 minutes once every 6 months, and from that position, they're expected to be an expert.
Yeah.
In that person and their illness.
Yeah.
And very often that means that people stay on the same medication for a very, very long time. It can be quite damaging to their health because there doesn't seem to be another way of managing it. Things change radically when people go into hospital, when people are sectioned, and then their medication is reviewed, and some occupational therapy can take place, and a sense of recovery and rehabilitation comes into it. But if people remain relatively stable in the community, then actually that can be to their disadvantage, I think, sometimes.
Mm, yeah. A lot of people in your profession presumably experience burnout, but you sound as if you've managed to avoid that. How have you done that?
I think it's because I find it intellectually interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm able to reflect quite successfully on what's happening and to find it interesting and to want to constantly ask the question why.
Yes.
And I think on the other hand, I have quite a busy family life that is a distraction to that. So I think that's probably why. And I have other interests. I have other burning interests. Which really helps, I think, me to keep my work in perspective, really.
And with all the cuts and the time constraints that are a consequence of that, has it affected your motivation in a way, in the sense of feeling that you're making a difference in your job?
I guess it does, yes. I think that we definitely feel the funding constraints every single day, and I know that less people are being funded, and the people that were perhaps being funded for adult social care 5 years ago aren't being funded now. They really have to be quite critical, in the sense that they, you know, will come to harm within days. I think that's how they define critical. So in that sense, the preventative work that I suppose it seems most meaningful to me isn't being done. It's all responsive work, responding to crises. In that sense, yes. But on the other hand, it has enabled me to realise that actually I need, you know, what the work that I need to do is with people on the front line, and I've been in a sort of supervisory role, so one step away for a few years now, and that it does feel quite ineffective on that level, because you can fund less people and you can do less work, I suppose, or you can do a lot of admin, but nothing that feels particularly meaningful. So It's inspired me to find a job on the front line again and to actually work directly with people.
Oh, that's great. I'm going back to your personal life a bit, Nina.
Yeah.
You became involved in the FWBO Buddhist organisation, now called Triatna, in the 1990s. How did you get involved with that, and how did that go? How did that pan out?
My first contact was on a retreat in Scotland, which was a hill walking retreat, and it was fantastic to learn to meditate. It was something I'd always wanted to do, and I loved it immediately. I loved it was like falling in love as an experience. I enjoyed it, and I was fascinated by it. My contact with the FWBO then continued for a number of years, and my involvement increased over those years. And I suppose it became quite painful for me to be part of the organisation in the end, partly because I wanted to have a family, and at that time there didn't seem to be a place for families within the FWBO. And secondly, because I didn't really understand the sense of, I suppose, what I would describe as guru worship, or the importance of the founder to the other people in the movement. And also the devotional element to Buddhism, or to the FWBO in particular. I couldn't connect with that as an idea.
Yeah.
I sort of came to the conclusion that really wasn't my path at all. I didn't have that kind of devotion either to the founder of the movement, or I didn't find that a helpful practice in Buddhism either. So I sort of withdrew really at that point.
And then around that time, did you go to Malawi, or was this later?
It was in the middle, actually. It was in the middle. I had just over a year in Malawi, I think. And much of that was on my own. I was teaching again. I was teaching in a university in the north of Malawi, the University of Mazuzu, and teaching English. But I was quite isolated in that role. And I spent a lot of my time alone, and reading a good deal about Buddhism, and doing a lot of meditation, and having quite a lot of, I suppose, what you call insightful experiences, which really inspired me to come back to. I think I was quite divided with whether I go off to India and learn about Buddhism more deeply there, or to come back to England. And I opted to come back to England, and to continue the path with the FWBO. But I suppose the contrast between that experience of solitude and study was with other people, other practicing Buddhists, or their difference from me and my experience was quite intense.
Yeah.
and quite alienating for me. Which is perhaps only to be expected given the intensity of what I'd just experienced, really.
I can remember in the 80s, I spent about 7 months in India, and it took me about a year to adjust when I came back. It was,
yeah.
I had such a culture shock.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you had your son in 2001.
Yeah.
And then when you had your first daughter in 2004,
yeah.
Feminism became a real passion for you.
Oh, it did, yes.
And you started reading texts on identity in a big way.
Yes.
Was this brought on by reflecting on your daughter's future, or what was it? What was the connection there?
It was quite an interesting time. I mean, I suppose I'd always intellectually been a feminist.
Yeah.
I'd always seen inequality and felt anger on other people's behalf. But being, I suppose, all three of my pregnancies, I felt very trapped, I suppose, in the structures of the NHS and felt a bit very much under pressure to behave in a certain way and to do what I was told.
Yeah.
When my daughter was born, it was my second child, the doctors, they actually told me that I couldn't possibly know when my child was conceived and that they needed to induce me. And I said, well, I do know when my child was conceived, and you're not inducing me. It was much more of a battle than that. And every time I went in to be monitored into the hospital, I got very, very stern glares from the nurses, clear disapproval. And in the end, she was born naturally with the support of some fantastic midwives. But I felt quite battered by that experience.
Yeah.
and very, very angry.
Yeah.
And emotional that they played lip service to the idea that I had choice as a woman, but actually they didn't mean it.
Yeah.
They were very disapproving, and they wanted me to do what the doctor wanted me to do. And it was a watershed moment for me, and I sort of made a vow to her, really, that I would fight for her.
Uh-huh.
I've continued to do that, and to be very, very driven to understand how all these gender differences that we see around us can result, or they can't possibly result from a small difference in chromosome. they have to result from almighty social structures that divide us, and so I suppose that's been my fascination and my passion since my daughter was born, that to understand those things and to break them down.
Okay, and then you said that you read these texts and you focused on Lacanian psychoanalysis, the French feminists, Judith Butler,
yeah,
Donna Haraway in particular. You said all these writers fit very well with the middle way. What is your understanding of the middle way, and how you feel these writers resonate with that understanding?
Well, I think what they're trying to achieve is a clearer way of understanding the experience of being a woman.
Yeah.
And it's not as simple as that men are out to get us. Clearly, that's not the case.
Uh-huh.
And all those writers going way back, actually, from Simone de Beauvoir forward, have sought to understand the structures that divide men and women.
Yeah.
And Lacan saw this difference in language, I suppose, particularly coming from French, where everything is elle or il. Everything, the whole world is divided into male and female. And that there's this binary construction. And, of course, from there comes the whole idea of the other and difference. And the French feminists developed on Lacan's idea. And that be that fundamentally, that for him, the Oedipus complex begins in language. It isn't that's what divides the child. That is the experience that is defining.
Okay.
So it's that division in language that's very, very important. And what Donna Haraway, what she does is she says, well, actually, we can't really escape this stuff, can we? But we need to find a way of escaping it. And she called on her experience of techno-science and science and I suppose science fiction as well, and said, well, actually, we can sidestep Oedipus, we can sidestep religious tradition, we can sidestep the history of the world if we become cyborgs.
Okay.
If we see ourselves as cyborgs. So that's a very inspiring image, I think.
And by cyborgs, could you just expand on that?
What she's saying is that we're in this world of the internet and computers and machines. We're all part machine. We communicate through machine. We're all implicated in that kind of those processes.
Yeah.
And the machines don't have the same gender experiences. It is possible to escape our past if we somehow take on the persona of techno-science.
Oh.
And it's sort of an inspirational image, I suppose, and a way of trying imaginatively to see a future where we don't have to be hindered by the past.
Okay, so it's a bit like what we're doing now using Skype.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so what was it, Nina, that attracted you to the Middle Way Society?
I think it's the combination of feeling that there has to be a way of changing the world for the better, and understanding that that can't be an entirely political movement.
Mm-hmm.
I think that politics generally is quite divisive, it seems to be unavoidably divisive. And I think the only way to avoid that is by using the middle way, really, of trying to understand things as they really are, rather than swinging to extremes.
Okay.
And understanding people's motivations.
Yeah.
And understanding that whatever camp you're in, you're neither all good nor all bad. It's just that your set of experiences have brought you to a particular conclusion, and to be really able to reflect and to come to a decision about what ethically is important, that for myself, really. What's, and particularly recently, what's been important is to, and I suppose what inspired me to join the society, is understanding what's useful to me and what isn't useful to me.
Okay.
And I think that the middle way is really important, to be able to shed the things that I don't need anymore, the things that can be helpful to take me forward.
So you have a belief then in moral progress in that sense?
I guess so. I guess I do have a belief in, I'm not sure whether to call it moral progress, but I have a sense that there are ethically right decisions that can be made,
yeah.
Which are quite often clouded by culture and history. Not least using the example of Buddhism, really, that it has so many great things in its history, so many very inspiring texts. But for women, it hasn't been such a great journey.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot in its history that doesn't really recognise women, and certainly in the images of women within Buddhism, and people say, oh well, you know, in the end there's neither male or female, but certainly in the art there very much seems to be a male and female, and these male and female figures are ascribed to different qualities. And there's a moment where I have to admit that that's not useful to me.
Yeah.
I need, you know, however I try and work with those and bend my mind around what people are telling me, actually that's not useful. And I need to take from Buddhism what is useful for me as a 21st century woman, and for my daughters,
yeah.
and for my son. And to think, well, how, what can we use? What can we use from this ancient tradition that's good, that can take us forward? And so, yeah, that's why I joined, to help me clarify those ideas, really.
Well, Sebastian, well, I hope we have lots of opportunities to discuss these things, you know, on the internet and in the community that we're starting.
Yeah, I really look forward to that. I'm really hoping that I can learn a lot from everyone. And I've certainly, so far, I've found it fascinating to read there's tons of material on the internet, isn't there? There's tons of it on the website. And some of the discussions on the forum have been really interesting. And just watching the development of people's arguments is also really... it's just very informative.
Yeah, no, I find that too, yeah. Anyway, yeah. It's been great talking to you, Nina. Thank you very much for giving your time today.
No problem at all. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Barry. Thank you for talking to me. It's great.
All right, then.
Thank you.
Okay.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.